This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Amateur Traveler, episode 544. Today, the Amateur Traveler talks about waterfalls and the Queen of Sheba, churches carved out of a single rock, camel caravans carrying salt, and a lake of lava as we go to Ethiopia. Welcome to the Amateur Traveler. I'm your host, Chris Christensen. If you were sponsoring this episode, we'd be talking about you, but instead, let's talk now about Ethiopia. I'd like to welcome the show Anwar from beyondmyfrontdoor.com, who's come to talk to us about Ethiopia. Anwar, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Chris. It's great to be here.
You are not in Ethiopia right now, but in Gaziantep, Turkey, which is amazing because we actually had a exchange student from that rather unknown city in Turkey, but you were recently in Ethiopia.
Yeah, I was just there at the end of October, beginning of November 2016 this year. So really recently, for about 2.5 weeks.
And let's not assume that everybody knows where Ethiopia is on the map. So you want to put it on a map for us?
Sure. It's in northeastern Africa, on the Horn of Africa. It kind of borders Eritrea, Somalia, Sudan, and Kenya.
Okay. It's
southeast of Sudan and west of Somalia and Eritrea.
And also near, just across the water from Yemen and Saudi Arabia. So we've just listed a lot of countries that people are not interested in going to. Why should they go to Ethiopia?
In fairness, when I had booked my trip originally, I didn't even know anything about Ethiopia myself. Like most people, my opinion of Ethiopia dates back to like the late 80s, early 90s, to the famine. So one of my friends was going to Ethiopia, and at last minute, I just changed my plans to join in on the trip. But actually, when I went to Ethiopia, I discovered how incredible of a place it is. It's actually a very big country with so many different regions. The north has a lot of beautiful historical areas, mountains. In the south, they have a tribal area. Unfortunately, I did not go to the south during this trip. And in the east, they have deserts and stuff. And there's a lot of ancient history there. There's a lot of religious history there. Ethiopia didn't have the same colonization period a lot of other African countries did. So it still contains a lot of its culture there. In general, it's actually a very interesting country to visit.
When you mentioned religious history, we've done one other show on Ethiopia, which is about the stone churches in Lalibela, Ethiopia. So people are interested in that. You can go listen to that show from quite a while back. But you did what? You flew into Addis Ababa, I'm assuming?
Mm-hmm. So I landed in Addis Ababa, and then I went up to Bahar Dar, which has several sites, including just the Blue Nile Falls, and there's monasteries in Lake Tana. I went up to Gondar, which has some castles, ancient castles, and then from there up to the Simien Mountains, which has a lot of beautiful hiking and vistas. And then from Gondar, I flew to Lalibela and saw the ancient churches, and then up to Aksum, which is another UNESCO site that's an ancient kingdom that ruled Ethiopia prior to Lalibela. So Aksum was probably from the 4th century BC to about the 10th century AD, and then Lalibela became the capital from like the 13th century to the 14th century. And then I actually extended my trip. I was originally planning to go back home after Aksum, but I ended up extending my trip and going to Mekele, which is the second largest city in Ethiopia, and from there to the Danakil, which is this lesser known area of Ethiopia way out there. I mean, Ethiopia is pretty far off the beaten path.
Mm-hmm.
And the Danakil is even further off the beaten path than that. And it's known for these salt flats and these very volcanic area. They have the sulfuric acid volcano area, as well as the world's only permanent lava lake. So it was really kind of out there, but it's on the border of Eritrea. It's a lot less touristy because of that reason, and maybe a little bit more dangerous, but I didn't really feel in danger there.
Excellent. We'll get back to that in a bit. Let's start back at the beginning here. What did you do in Addis Ababa, or what do you recommend?
I didn't actually spend too much time personally in Addis Ababa. It was more of a transit area.
Mm-hmm.
My friend was already in Addis Ababa, so when I arrived, we basically just exchanged money, and we flew that night to Bahar Dar. On the way back, at the end of my trip, I stopped at Addis for about a day and just walked around, did some shopping, and I ended up getting pickpocketed in Addis, which was an experience in itself. I ended up getting my wallet back, which is actually a stranger part of the whole story. So in Addis Ababa, there's this really large market area called Mercado, and it's actually really well known as a place to get pickpocketed. So I ended up trying to pay attention to that whole thing. But as I was walking through with a friend I had made in Ethiopia, somebody had grabbed my arm and pulled me and tried to act like he was going to kick me. And I realized as soon as he grabbed my arm and pulled me, somebody had grabbed my wallet out of my pocket. And that's a very common thing where people will grab you and someone else will steal your wallet.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew right away that something happened. I went to reach for my wallet and noticed my wallet was gone. So I turned to the person who grabbed me. He was still pretty close to me and I was ready to fight with him. But then the guy next to him who had actually grabbed my wallet ended up giving me back my wallet. I was kind of in shock that that happened, but I was thankful I got my wallet back because that would have pretty well ruined my trip and coming back to Turkey and everything after that.
Hmm. So you flew out of Addis and then went up to Bahar Dar?
Yes. So I flew from Addis to Bahar Dar. Bahar Dar is famous for two things. There is the Blue Nile Falls, and mm-hmm. there's the Lake Tana Monasteries. And so in Bahar Dar, I went and saw both of those things. The Blue Nile Falls actually are these large waterfalls. While I was in Ethiopia, there was this big state of emergency, and probably around Bahar Dar was the only place I actually saw some level of a military presence. On our way to the Blue Nile Falls, we ended up seeing a lot of military vehicles going down this path to a village. As a tourist, you didn't really have any interactions too much. There may have been some police stops on occasion, but that was probably the only thing we noticed related to the state of emergency. But from there, the falls themselves were pretty big falls. And they said, generally speaking, the falls are actually pretty small because of the dam upriver. But when we were there, they said something with the state of emergency had some problems with the hydroelectric or the dam. And so the falls were at full force. So they were quite a spectacular falls at the time we were there. The other main thing to see in Bahar Dar is this other area called the Lake Tana Monasteries, and they have all these monasteries surrounding this big lake. And you take a boat ride out to all the different monasteries. Some of the monasteries are accessible by road, but several of them you can only get to by boat. They're actually on these small islands within the lake. The lake is really big, and it's also where the mouth of the Blue Nile, the river, is as well. And so it's a really good place in the lake to see hippopotami. We actually saw several hippopotami on the lake. That was more exciting for me to see than the actual monasteries, to be honest. But the monasteries are really nice, too, is that they have a lot of beautiful paintings from the Ethiopian Orthodox Church. And they're still being used extensively. So we're still having several services while we were there. We saw a lot of the local people going there as well, besides just tourists. While we were there, there weren't very many tourists at all. So some of these places we ended up having all to ourselves.
And we talk about the Ethiopian church. So the Ethiopian church goes back to biblical days. I mean, it's quite an old church, which is one of the reasons that Ethiopia is a little different from some of its neighbors that way.
There are some similarities with some of the Coptic traditions in nearby Egypt, mm-hmm. but they have their own set of beliefs and ways of practice and stuff. And you could really tell in Ethiopia that the people there were very religious, whatever their religion may be. Ethiopia is probably about 40-some percent Orthodox, about 20% Protestant, and probably not 35% or so Muslim. It actually surprised me how Islamic the country was, too. It's almost 40% Muslim,
mm-hmm.
where a lot of the places you actually see tend to be related to the ancient Christian traditions. And there were some really incredible places. And you did notice, too, for instance, in the cuisine, when I was actually going to eat a lot of places, I thought it was really weird that all these menus would have fasting menus. What is a fasting menu?
What? Yeah.
Because they don't eat meat and dairy products on Wednesdays and Fridays, and also during Lent and during other types of religious days, they have a lot of cuisine that's actually really good for like vegetarians, for instance. And some restaurants would only serve the fasting menu on a Wednesday or a Friday. So if you want to eat meat on a Friday, pay attention to where you're going.
Hmm, interesting.
We didn't do too much else in Bahar Dar. The city itself is really nice. It's pretty small. You can easily walk around it. From Bahar Dar, we ended up taking a bus up to Gonder, just on the other side of the lake from Bahar Dar. The lake is quite big, but we ended up spending more time around Gonder. This city itself of Gonder is kind of small, and there's not a lot to see in Gonder. There's this old castles from various different periods. It's called the Royal Enclosure, and they have several castles within the Royal Enclosure from various different periods. There's even a few that were modified when the Italians were in Ethiopia. There was some brief attempts at occupation and colonization from the Italians. They never got a large foothold in Ethiopia. There's another bath area related to the Royal Enclosure where you fill it up and people will do a massive baptism once a year in this royal baths. But the main reason most people go to Gonder, nearby Gonder, there's actually a really large national park called the Simien Mountains National Park. It's probably a bigger reason as to why people go to Gonder is actually to trek in the Simien Mountains, which are absolutely incredible. It was one of the first UNESCO sites in Ethiopia, and it was founded by a Welsh-Japanese man who fell in love with the park. He wrote a book about the park called The Roof of Africa. I think it was like in the 60s when this park was founded. There's quite a few animals and plants in that park that are endemic only to that area of Ethiopia. There's these a lot of baboons. These types of baboons, they also call bleeding heart baboons because of this red patch on their chest. They don't actually have the red ass of the other baboons you might see in other places. And there's also this Ethiopian wolf, which is endemic only to that area. And they're actually very rare to see. We saw one from very far away. It was too far away for us me to take a picture of it, but I actually did see an Ethiopian wolf. And they have also a lot of other monkeys and ibexes and some other kinds of antelopes and stuff in this park. The park itself is massive, and the elevations are pretty high, so you have to really be careful about altitude sickness. So most of the campsites we stayed at were above 3,000 feet. The highest peak in Ethiopia is also in that park called Rosh Dashen. So a lot of people will go to the park to hike up Rosh Dashen, but you don't actually need to hike up Rosh Dashen, and there's a lot of other beautiful vistas. If I have to say, some of the most beautiful vistas in Ethiopia I saw in this park, looking out from the mountains across the valley, are just absolutely incredible. We spent about 4 days in the park, which is probably about a day or two too much, especially since I actually did not pack correctly for the hiking in the park. I mean, it's like during the day, the park is really warm. It was kind of nice and sunny, but at night it dropped below zero. I did not really pack winter gear for the park, so I was pretty well freezing once the sun set. It was definitely roughing it. The campsites were comfortable. They had little kitchen areas, and we booked our trip through a local guy that one of my friends had found. And so they handle getting the guide and the scout and the cooks and the porters. And there's donkey guides who will take your stuff from each campsite for each day. So you only have to carry about a small day pack, and then you hire cooks. And you also have a guide and a scout. So the scout is the only person that's required for hiking in the Simien Mountains. So everybody who hikes in the Simien Mountains needs a scout, which is basically a guy with a gun who follows you around for your whole time. I guess the idea is that if you meet any wild animals that could be dangerous, he's there to protect you. I think this was more of an issue probably 40 years ago, probably when there was more wildlife in the park, but it's still like a way of giving jobs to the local community. It is a little disconcerting sometimes when there's these guys, you see everyone, these guys with these guns over their shoulders walking around with you. And you're just kind of like, so who are they protecting me from?
Right. Well, and it does look like the park is on the list of endangered UNESCO World Heritage Sites because of increasing human encroachment into the area.
Yeah, you do notice a lot of that. And they're trying to change that is that there's actually a lot of villages within the park itself. And because of that, there's a lot of grazing. You see a lot of monkeys and baboons and stuff, but you end up seeing quite a few cows and goats as well. And in certain areas, you can actually tell the ground is eroding due to overgrazing. So you definitely notice the encroachment of the people. It's a hard thing because there were villages in there for so long, and some of the villages are moving out. Mm-hmm. And it's a beautiful place. If you grew up, it's a beautiful place to live. And a lot of these villagers are being moved to Debark, which is the gateway to the Simien Mountains. And Debark is pretty run down in some places. It looks like it's overcrowded in some places. So you wonder if you grew up on a farm up in the mountains and now you're stuck down here in this small village town, what do you do? Mm-hmm. Can you still have your same livelihood down there? In the Simien Mountains, one of my favorite things was the lack of light pollution. So at night, even though it was freezing cold, I didn't necessarily want to be outside, but it was so beautiful. Like the stars you would see in the sky and the sunsets were absolutely incredible. And so I think even though I was probably going to die of hypothermia, it was fantastic to be out there and get to see that.
Cool. What's next?
From there, I ended up going to Lalibela. So you mentioned that you had talked to about Lalibela before. Lalibela was famous for these rock-hewn churches. There's about 11 of them. Mm-hmm. The most famous of which is this one called St. George, which is kind of like the most perfect one of them. It's, if you ever look up pictures of Lalibela, it's basically the picture you always see everywhere. Lalibela was a king, I think, from like the 13th century. Mm-hmm. So the name Lalibela actually means honey eater. As legend was, when he was born, there was all this swarm of bees that were around him, and they didn't sting him, but they actually fed him honey, and apparently was a sign that he was going to be the king of Ethiopia. Supposedly he had this dream. In this dream, he was supposed to start creating these churches. He built all these churches during his lifetime, and supposedly with help of the angels, he had like a divine kind of power. It was part of the thing where all these churches were carved out of stone.
And when you say carved out of stone, we should describe, just for people who aren't either looking at the pictures that we've got in the enhanced version here or haven't heard about it before, we're not talking about carved out of stone like Petra in Jordan, for instance, where you're carving into the rock face or something like that. But literally, this is kind of like getting the model that says carve away everything that doesn't look like a church.
Basically, yeah. So it's actually one single piece of rock. It looks like the ground and they're kind of dug down, but literally like all the hallways and the windows and everything, it's all carved out of this single piece of rock, which was really interesting. They don't even have pillars inside. When you look inside, you're like, how did they actually design and build this thing? There's not even pillars inside this thing. They really just literally like dug it out with stone chisels, or
would have had steel chisels by then. But and they're not all that big. I mean, if you're comparing them to a European cathedral size, for instance, they're relatively small churches.
Correct. They don't actually hold too many people inside, especially, but from the scale of them being built out of a piece of stone is incredible. Mm-hmm. Multi-story with all these windows.
That was one of the highlights, I'm guessing, of the trip, or at least it was one of the reasons that got you to Ethiopia, because it's what a lot of people have heard about. What surprised you about the actually seeing them in person?
Number one, how many of them there were. Mm-hmm. Some of them are wearing down a little bit, and they've been building different ways of protecting them from the elements. But the fact that they've actually managed to stay pretty well intact for so many years, they're really well done. You look at the detail on the windows, on the carvings and stuff, and how straight a lot of the edges are. There's a lot of that detail still left there. And the fact that they're still being used regularly. Sure, these things are tourist sites, but the locals still go there for regular services. One morning we were there, it was actually the feast day of St. George. Mm-hmm. And so we ended up getting up before 6 a.m. to get to the St. George Church. And there were just hundreds of locals there praying and all wrapped in their white cloth, going through prayers and chanting and doing these ceremonial baptisms. To me, that was the most incredible thing. You still really see the religion and the importance of these places to the people there.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. Where to next?
From there, I ended up going to Aksum, which is a more ancient civilization than Lalibela. The Aksumite civilization predates Lalibela by several hundred years, and it was probably the first kingdom in Ethiopia. So they have a lot of really ancient sites there. They have these old obelisks, they call them stele, which are these obelisks with these engravings. And there are several of them inside the city. One of them had been taken by Italy and just recently repatriated. According to legend, it's also where the Ark of the Covenant is in Ethiopia. So there's this old monastery and the chapel with the Ark of the Covenant and several really important churches. And so one interesting thing about the churches is there's a new church of St. Mary's next to the monastery and the Ark of the Covenant chapel. And they built that church because the monastery and where the Ark of the Covenant area is off limits to women.
Oh, hmm.
My friend who I was with, she wasn't allowed to go into the monastery. Only I was allowed to go in the monastery. So I had to go in and take pictures and show her of them later. So they have this other church now, this Church of St. Mary, where women can actually pray as well. And we went to visit the Ark of the Covenant. It's in this chapel area with a fence around it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a priest stays inside the chapel. And every time he dies, they end up replacing this priest. It's a really important position, but his area of he can travel to is only up to the fence there. The locals we saw could go up to the fences where the Ark of the Covenant chapel was. But so I asked my tour guide, am I allowed to walk up to the fence? And he's like, no, you have to stay this far back. And I was really confused. He said, well, several years ago, there was a tourist from Israel who tried to jump over the fence and claim that the Ark belonged to Israel. And since then, they have not allowed tourists to go anywhere near even the fence of the chapel.
Huh. Interesting. Well, and certainly not allowed to visit or take pictures or anything like that.
You can take pictures outside, but you can't take pictures inside. Yeah. I don't know if anyone's actually ever seen, maybe besides obviously the priest who goes in there, but I asked if any of the locals had seen the actual Ark of the Covenant, and they said no, they just know it's in there through belief. Some of the other churches in Aksum, they have replicas of the Ark of the Covenant that they take around the city for various religious ceremonies.
Hmm. What else did you do in Aksum?
According to Ethiopian legend, Aksum is also where the Queen of Sheba is from. So the Queen of Sheba, obviously, the legend with Solomon and her immense beauty. The interesting thing about the Queen of Sheba is that she plays a factor in the history of several countries, like especially nearby countries such as Yemen. Yemen also claims that the Queen of Sheba came from Yemen. In Aksum, it's very important for the Aksumite and the Ethiopian mythology that the Queen of Sheba comes from there, because supposedly the son of Solomon and the Queen of Sheba is a person who brought the Ark of the Covenant back to Ethiopia. They have several different archaeological areas that they claim belong to the Queen of Sheba. There's this old palace, ruins of a palace that they claim was the Queen of Sheba's palace. There's this large pool of water that they claim is holy. They claim some kind of connection with the Queen of Sheba as well, like she would bathe there or something related to that. Our tour guide wasn't too convincing in terms of how they trace it actually to the Queen of Sheba, other than it was very old.
Uh-huh.
For them, the Queen of Sheba is obviously very important. Beyond that, there's a few tombs of old Aksumite kings. There's this really interesting carving with several different languages on it, kind of like a Rosetta Stone for Ethiopia in a way.
Hmm, interesting. Well, and I don't want to express skepticism about the son of the Queen of Sheba and Solomon get to walk out of Israel with the Ark of the Covenant, but I am skeptical about that. Not something they're going to let me in and take pictures of so that I can verify or anything like that.
Our guide was saying that they're going to move the Ark of the Covenant soon. They're building a new, brand new building next to that building. I don't know if it's leaking or there's some structural issues with the current chapel, but that seemed like the next year or two, they're going to be actually moving the Ark to another building. So I don't know if then people will see it or what is the situation in that case when they actually move the Ark.
Hmm. Interesting. And where did you go after Aksum?
I traveled from Aksum to Mekele, and I didn't spend any time in Mekele, but it's the embarkment point for trips into the Danakil.
Mm-hmm.
To be honest, the Danakil was probably by far my most favorite part of Ethiopia. It's pretty out there and pretty remote. Ethiopia doesn't get very many tourists in general, especially now with the state of emergency going on. We noticed that tourism had pretty well collapsed while we were there. You could basically walk up to a city and actually have your choice of hotels. There was no hotel that was full. Quite a few hotels we were in, really, we were the only people staying there. It was a little bit crazy how bad tourism had gotten. In terms of places in Ethiopia, like the Danakil, even further, less touristy than there. I mean, it's pretty remote. It's pretty undeveloped. In some ways, it's a little dangerous, or at least it's on the no-go list for a lot of countries.
Mm-hmm. And even without that, it's also the hottest place in the planet where people live normally.
Correct. It was pretty hot while we were there. And to them, it was like, no, this is the not hot time of year. It still got up to about 40 Celsius while we were there in some
Ouch.
Places. And this is the winter months. So
we're talking about the Danakil Depression. What did you do while you were there? You went out in a tour?
It is one of those places that you really can do as a solo person. It would be almost impossible to do as a solo trekker, especially if you don't speak Afar or Tigray or Amharic or one of the local languages, especially if you don't speak Afar, because there are so many different things you'd have to plan as an individual to do it, such as fees you'd have to pay to the village elders, and there's camel rentals, and there's police escorts you'd have to negotiate. So we ended up taking a tour of the Danakil Hill, and so we ended up doing like a four-day tour of the Danakil Hill itself. The main sites you see on most of the tours, there's like a couple of main areas. There is the salt flats, where they still do salt mining for the different camels. There's the Dalal, which is this sulfuric volcanic area that when I showed my friends pictures of this place back home, they almost thought I was on a different planet. I mean, it was just brightly colored. It was like these bubbling areas of green and blue and red and all these different colors. And it seemed like literally like it was out of this world. And there's Urta Ali, which is this volcano. And the reason people go to the volcano is it's famous for having the longest existing lava lake in the world. It's been there for about 40 years or 30 years, this volcano, this lake. So it's literally a lake of lava in the center of this volcano. The volcano I thought was going to be the highlight of my trip. It wasn't actually. I think the Dalal with the sulfuric pools was probably the highlight of my trip. But the volcano, while we were there, it was much more active. The level of the lava was really high. It was so high that I was going back over the rim of the crater of the lake. Usually you can actually walk up basically up to the crater.
Right.
And look into the crater of the volcano and look down the lake. But because it was so active and the lava was so high, we had to stay about 150, 200 meters away from the edge of the volcano. And even then, these clouds of sulfur gas blowing in our direction, you could actually see waves of lava move through the lake and sometimes hit the edges, and lava would spurt up in the air and fall off the edges. So it probably was good that we weren't that close, because we'd probably be dead.
Well, and Gary Art, who's been on the show numerous times, did a trip recently with the tourism board there and wouldn't necessarily recommend the tour group that he went with, because you talk about you go to the lake, you're sort of skipping over some things like he described walking through the night over the hot desert for hours to get to the lake, first of all, and then also his guide that was not well run, as I said, they weren't told to bring water, there wasn't enough water, they were getting dehydrated, they get up to the lake, there's clouds of noxious gases that really overpower a couple of people who have to back away. They saw another tour group there that had gas masks. It's like, well, that seems like that would have been a good idea. So did you have a better experience with your tour guides?
I think I did. I mean, in general, they were really prepared. It was still pretty roughing it for a lot of places. You're camping outside. Most of the things were open air.
Sure.
In one of the areas we were staying in the Danakil, it was kind of like a guest lodge. So that was nice. You're still basically sleeping on the floor on mats. But I found that they really provided us well with water. They seemed to really know where to go and where not to go. I mean, these guys run tours, it seems like, every day. After they run our tour, they'll run the next tour. We didn't have gas masks, although gas masks would have been really nice. They told us to bring something to tie around your face or something to guard against the gas, because it's going to be pretty bad, you know, from the sulfur smell.
That at least is more prepared than they were having. Who did you go with? Who was the tour company?
ETT, like Ethio Travel and Tours, was the company I went with.
Okay.
They're pretty well known in Ethiopia, and they're pretty well established there. That was good. So they seemed to know people in all the villages we were going at. They had everything was set up ahead of time, so we didn't really get stopped too often. There were areas we had to stop when they had to go get the police escorts and this and that. But in general, they seemed to be really well run. I really liked them overall. As a general group, they seem to really kind of know exactly where to go. They made sure everybody was there. They made sure we were all safe.
Were you using them for the whole trip or just for this part of the trip?
Just for this part of the trip.
Okay.
Most of the trip I basically did on my own. So I kind of winged it. I didn't actually have a tour book or anything. I just winged getting through Ethiopia. But in general, like most people follow a certain path. But because of the difficulty of doing the Danakil, I knew I had to book with a tour. And so you have to make sure you go with the reputable thing too, because there's so many things that can go wrong in the Danakil.
Right.
Like when you're going out to these places too, they're pretty remote too. Like the road to the volcano, for instance, is probably one of the worst roads I've ever been on. It's volcanic rock, it's desert, it's other areas. People could break down. They're always traveling in convoys. we were in several Land Cruisers, and almost every Land Cruiser had a flat tire at some point because of just how bad the roads are and stuff. So they were pretty quick. One of the cars had multiple spare tires on the roof of the car, so they came down and quickly changed the tire. They knew exactly what they were doing in every place.
We didn't talk about the rest of your trip. Were you getting around on public transportation? Did you have a car rental or a driver, or how did you do the rest of the trip?
Most of the trip, we ended up flying between places, partly because some of the areas are really difficult to drive between the two places. Either it was really long or the roads are really bad. And we're trying to save some time in terms of getting between places. Because Ethiopia is so large, the distances are so big. The one thing I wish I had known prior to coming to Ethiopia, though, was if I had to do it again, I would have flown on Ethiopian Airlines as my international carrier into Ethiopia. Because if you fly on Ethiopian Airlines into Ethiopia, you qualify for discounted tickets within the country on Ethiopian Airlines.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
So had I known that, I could have saved a significant amount of money inside the country. I ended up finding a really cheap flight into Ethiopia, but I didn't realize it ended up costing me more because I couldn't save money on the flights within Ethiopia.
Interesting. Okay. Good to know.
I did take one trip by car on the road from Bahar Dar to Gondar, and then from Gondar to the Simien Mountains, obviously, by road is the only way to get it there. And the road there is pretty terrible as well, but in general, flying is the best way to get around.
Excellent. Are there other stops we want to talk about, or do we want to do some overview questions now?
I want to talk a little bit more about the Danakil. One of the other highlights of the Danakil is the salt flats itself. The salt is a very valuable resource in the Danakil, and the locals depend significantly on the salt. And they actually have these caravans of camels that travel 7 days from Mekelle to the salt flats and then 7 days back. And so you see these caravans of camels walking through the desert, and they get there and they mine these blocks of salt, these 5 kilograms blocks of salt. Their whole job is just to mine salt. Like, the camels will come and they'll cut the salt, and they probably make about 2 or 3 burr per block of salt. It's really hard manual labor out in the hot sun. It's about 22 burr for a dollar. So they're not making a whole lot of money, but they'll do about 200 blocks a day. So about 600 burr a day, which is $27, $28, which is actually quite a bit of money for a local to make as a daily wage. But it's really hard work. It was 40 degrees Celsius while we were there in the wintertime. I mean,
wow. So like 104 Fahrenheit.
It gets up to probably 50s. It's really hard labor, so like a young man's job. But that was one of the more interesting things, too, because these days they're building these roads out there now. And one of the reasons they're building all these roads is because tourism is growing. So one road we went out to the lake into the salt areas before used to be a dirt road, and now it's a paved road. And they said they just made it last year because of the tourism, because of other developments. The thing is, a lot of the tourists come to see these things, but because of these developments, eventually the camels and all these things are going to go away because the roads are better. They can bring trucks there. They're going to have less need for camels. At some point, some of these ways of life are going to change because of these developments.
Yeah, sure. I'm not sure that that's a bad thing if you're the person who is having to do the camel ride for 7 days, but it's certainly going to be a big change in terms of what you're going to see when you go there.
Probably these people, their skill set is probably leading camels. So you wonder if they're going to be able to transfer their skills maybe to be a truck driver. I don't know. The thing about change, it doesn't affect everybody equally. And they tend to be very kind of isolationist. A lot of these Afar people tend to kind of keep to themselves. So if more and more development comes there, how is that going to affect the local people? I think it's still yet to be determined.
Right. Well, and we should say that Anwar works with the NGO, and so you're sensitive to these sort of issues.
Every now I'm just volunteering with an NGO, but my normal job is actually an engineer, but I do find that interesting. Even development aid and stuff like that that goes to places, the effects that it does, the positives and negatives.
Right, absolutely. This is one of those trips that's a little more off the grid. So when did you feel closest to home? This is very familiar. And when did you feel furthest from home? I don't know where I am now.
Closest to home, probably. It's really funny because I spend so much time away from home these days that lately my home right now has been in Turkey. And before that, I was actually living in Saudi Arabia doing some business there. So like, it's been a while since I've been home in the U.S. actually. So closest and furthest to home. Kind of the small things. For instance, in Gondar, we stayed in this wonderful hotel. Nice service and the people and stuff like that. I think that kind of made me feel a lot more comfortable. It was more and more relaxed. Furthest from home was probably in the Danakil when you feel like you're almost on like the surface of Mars landscapes and you're like, oh my God, you know, it's almost like a dream. Like, I can't believe I'm here thing. Looking back on it now, it doesn't even feel real.
Excellent. And I think you already mentioned this, but if I tell you you're standing at the prettiest spot, where are you standing and what are you looking at?
I was standing the prettiest spot in Ethiopia, at least for me, was probably in the Simien Mountains. Mm-hmm. On several of the mountain peaks we were on, like the views were just breathtaking. Like you're looking out on these green valleys and these green mountains around you and these beautiful trees with this moss. It's kind of like the Spanish moss that they have like in the south in the U.S.
Yep.
Almost like an ethereal feeling with the fog moving in. That's probably where the most beautiful spot I thought it was in, that I saw in Ethiopia.
Excellent. One thing that makes you laugh and say only in Ethiopia.
But I think only in Ethiopia, these small kind of hole-in-the-wall places with these local people having coffee and some local injera, and it's absolutely delicious, fresh coffee, fresh roasted. And the whole thing probably costs you like a dollar. A place you wouldn't go to normally at home, but there just seems normal. Like it's like a side of the road, like small place.
The Ethiopian should know coffee. I mean, we're talking about a place that basically coffee goes back to.
Coffee and the honey were both fantastic. And the most requested gifts for people back in Turkey when they knew I was going to Ethiopia, everybody was asking me for a coffee and honey.
Interesting. Well, we didn't talk about Ethiopian food too, because I'm not sure that everybody knows what Ethiopian food is like. Can you describe a typical Ethiopian meal?
So typical Ethiopian meal tends to be like a large dish. And on the bottom of the dish tends to be called injera, which is made from this local grain called teff. And it's kind of like a bread. It's a little bit spongy, tends to be brown.
Flat bread.
Tends to be a little bit sour in taste. Mm. And on top of the injera, they tend to put little piles of different kinds of meats and vegetables. And they'll also often give you extra injera on the side. And you take pieces of the injera and you use it to scoop up the food.
Mm-hmm.
Eat with your hands, but you eat by using the injera bread. I love the injera. I thought it was fantastic, but I met a lot of travelers who found it a little bit too sour.
Excellent.
Can I change the thing that makes me laugh in Ethiopia?
Sure.
For me, the one thing that made me laugh in Ethiopia was that a lot of people thought I was Ethiopian.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting. My ancestry comes from the Middle East and from India.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed that the longer I spent in Ethiopia, the darker I got. And the more locals thought I was Ethiopian. So one thing that was really funny for me was I was with my friend and we met these two other girls from Australia and we were sitting in this restaurant. The one lady came in and she kind of looked at me directly and then started speaking to me Amharic. And she thought I was actually the tour guide of the group. And
oh,
so
fine.
I was like, I don't speak Amharic. I'm American. She just like died laughing and ran out of the room.
Funny. Finish this thought. You really know you're in Ethiopia when what?
Really know you're in Ethiopia when you're in the small hole-in-the-wall kind of place drinking fresh brewed coffee that's fresh roasted. A lot of local people and some local injera, and it's incredible. And the food's always incredible, and it's really cheap, and coffee is fantastic. I ended up taking some of the coffee back with me. You do have to be careful. Supposedly, you can't take the unroasted coffee out of the country, which I
really?
Didn't know.
Huh.
Yeah, I didn't know that. Someone told me that after I took it out already. And the honey actually is also really good from Ethiopia. They have this Ethiopian white honey, which is really famous in Ethiopia, and you'll find it in some of the cities. It's kind of mixed with the honeycomb.
Yeah.
So it's actually almost like a paste. Regular honey, it'll kind of move. Like the white honey doesn't actually move.
Interesting.
Almost like a ball. And it's absolutely delicious and really incredible. And I never had anything like it other than in Ethiopia. So one of my friends here, he's originally from Sudan, and when he found out I was going to Ethiopia, he's like, bring me back Ethiopian white honey. And that's when I discovered it, was that I was like, oh, wow, I never knew this existed.
Excellent. And if you had to summarize Ethiopia in three words, what three words would you use?
Expansive. A lot of these areas were just really big. You know, these areas like the Danakil, these huge desert areas, huge valleys. I just found it like, I found these areas to just be kind of breathtaking and expansive. Historical. One of the things I really liked about Ethiopia was that in a lot of areas, they have a really rich and really strong history there. And I thought that was really incredible to see these ancient areas and ancient civilizations. And probably religious. I was really taken by how faithful people were to their faith, how much the religion played in the roles in people's lives. Even like our tour guides, when they went to the churches, how important it was, how much of a connection they felt to these places.
Excellent. Our guest again has been Anwar. Anwar, where can people read more about your travels?
You can read more about my travels on my blog at beyondmyfrontdoor.com.
Thanks for coming on The Amateur Traveler and sharing with us your love for Ethiopia.
Thank you for having me, Chris. It's been great.
In news of the community, I heard today from Nick, who said, "Dear Chris, it's taken 18 months, but I have now listened to all the podcasts and have enjoyed them immensely. Due to disability, I'm no longer able to travel much, and although I get envious sometimes, I love hearing other people's travel stories. Generally, I find that the more independent the traveler, the more interesting the podcast. A very few done by professionals have had a rather travel-weary slant to them, as in, the hotel that night had no shoeshiner. And others have had travel bore shallowness of, oh, the Bahamas were simply wonderful type. I have made both of those up as I do not want to be specific. However, the vast majority have been excellent and very informative. I have especially enjoyed the podcasts on more unusual places such as North Korea, St. Helena, the Pacific Islands, Northwest China, Iran, and so many others. Above all, I love the sheer enthusiasm and joy people have for their chosen destination. Claire describing Oman last week was a delight. I think she had the historical, cultural, and natural interest to paint a wonderful picture of a country I knew little about. I cannot go there, but wish anyone able to go to have a great time there or anywhere they go. Finally, don't knock yourself, Chris, about your own travel stories. One of my favorite episodes was your tour of southern France, Italy, etc. many years ago. They are always interesting and have an honesty about them as well as good traveler's humility to say that you didn't enjoy and admitting to things that went not so well. I wish you well in Japan and India. Look forward to hearing about your adventures there. Just don't start by saying, Oh, Fujiyama was simply gorgeous, though it probably is. Best wishes, Nick." Thanks so much, Nick, and I'll have to remember that when we do the show from Japan. And speaking of which, there are still a number of slots available for both the Japan trip and the India trip. It's now 2017 or later, depending on when you're listening to this. The holidays are over, and you have no excuse for not thinking about coming with us. With that, we're going to end this episode of The Amateur Traveler. If you have a question, send an email to host@amateurtraveler.com or use the respond button like Nick did right on amateurtraveler.com. Join the Facebook group where we're having an interesting conversation, facebook.com/amateurtraveler. And as always, thanks so much for listening.